Everybody needs just the right amount of fuel to get going in the morning. For some, a nice McDonald's egg and cheese bagel is just enough to do it. Others might prefer a McDonald's bacon egg and cheese bagel. Or perhaps a sausage egg and cheese bagel. And there are those where nothing will do but a hearty McDonald's steak egg and cheese bagel. Four different breakfast bagels to get you going. Tomorrow morning, give your engine a head start at participating McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Hi, I'm John Bearer, the host and lead researcher for Stories of Sacrifice, American POW-MIA podcast, and the U.S. POW-MIA Family Locating. A free forensic genealogy public service I provide to support POW-MIA families trying to get their loved one identified and brought home. First, I want to thank you, our listeners, for your interest in the Stories of Sacrifice podcast. Our goal with the podcast is to tell the world about the sacrifice these brave heroes gave for the freedoms we enjoy every day. They gave our country their last full measure. They give us their tomorrow for our freedom today. Second, we would like to raise public awareness that thousands of these heroes from World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and the Cold War have still not yet been found or returned to the United States, with many still buried as unknowns in our own national cemeteries. Their families still waiting for our government to disinter and identify them. So what can you do to support this important mission? First, if you are a relative of a missing in action service member, you can visit the Defense POW-MIA Accounting Agency website for more information about providing a family reference DNA sample. If you want more information, you can also contact me at john@uspowmiafamilylocating.com. Even if you're not related to an MIA, you can contact your members of Congress to request they allocate enough funding to support the POW-MIA mission and to change the DPAA policy to a DNA lead process and create additional public partnerships to disinter and process the remains for those that are buried as unknown. You can also help us in our mission by sharing these podcast stories with your friends, family, and consider sharing them on your own social media. We would also appreciate if you could leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. You can also visit www.storiesofsacrifice.org and leave us a review there. You can visit our affiliate links on our website where we will earn a small commission on your purchases at no extra cost to you. If you feel moved to do so, please visit our donation links on our website to help us continue this important mission. Just sharing these stories helps us greatly, and we cannot thank you enough for listening. Sit back and relax, and we hope you enjoy today's show. Welcome to Stories of Sacrifice, World War II American POW-MIA's podcast, the voice of the missing in action and the voice of those buried as unknowns in our national cemeteries. I'm your host and lead researcher, John Bearer.
Over 75,000 service members are still listed as missing in action from World War II. Of those, over 30,000 are currently listed as active pursuit by the Defense POW-MIA Accounting Agency. Active pursuit meaning they could possibly be identified with the proper family reference sample DNA being on file with the Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. The process of donating DNA reference material is easy, painless, and free of charge. If you are the relative of a missing service member, you can contact the Service Casualty Office of the MIA for information on how to provide a DNA sample. The Service Casualty Office will mail to your home a DNA donor kit that contains a donor consent form, instruction form, three cheek swabs, and a shipping envelope. All you have to do is fill out the paperwork, rub the inside of your cheek with the swabs, place the swabs back into the containers, and affix the label. The collected samples are then placed in a pre-addressed and prepaid envelope and then mailed to the Armed Forces DNA Identification Lab at Dover. That's it. It's a completely painless process. To get more information about your missing in action relative, you can visit our website, uspowmiafamilylocating.com, and we can help you to determine if your relative is currently listed on the DPAA active pursuit list and the next steps to help get them identified. Just visit our website or email john@uspowmiafamilylocating.com.
Welcome to today's podcast. Today we're talking about Private Israel Goldberg, who was born in Massachusetts and was the son of Russian immigrants who served with Headquarters Squadron 24th Pursuit Group. On the phone today, I'm interviewing his great-great-niece, Liberty Phillips. How you doing, Liberty?
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. Israel Goldberg sometimes goes by the name Sewell. He was born on January 20, 1913 to his immigrant parents, Samuel and Eva Goldberg. Samuel had come over, immigrated from Russia in 1904, I believe, and Eva came a couple years later in 1908. They were married, and they had his older sister, Gertrude, who was born in 1911, and then Israel came along in 1913. They were really hard workers, and there's a funny story our family likes to tell about. I think it's Samuel, who he had a stopover point in Poland on his way, and he sold penny whistles to earn enough money to come to America. And one day he kept his money in a stove, and his mother, one of his family, turned the stove on and burned up all the money. So he had to start all over.
Oh no.
It was a tragedy, but they eventually made it over to America, and then Israel was born. So Israel kind of had a lot of tragedy throughout his life, which partly affected why he joined the army before the war even started. 6 months after he was born, his mom, Eva, died. Now, what I understand, I don't know a lot about how she died, but she'd just gone into the hospital for a small surgery or a checkup. And the story is that she called for a bedpan to use a bathroom, and it didn't come. So she got out of bed and she slipped, banged her head, and died. This really affected Israel and his sister's Gertrude's life growing up, because they lost their mom at a very young age. And a couple years later, their dad, Samuel, remarried. And after that, Israel just had a really strained relationship with his father. They referred to the stepmom as the woman, and she wasn't like a wicked stepmom, but she just was difficult. So when Israel was about 29 in 1940, I think it is, he signed up with the Army Air Corps and was shipped overseas to the Pacific. His sister Gertrude had gotten married a couple years before. There wasn't really anything to hold him back home, so that's where he went. And then, obviously, a year later, war breaks out and he's captured. So there's not a lot of information between what happened when he got over to the Pacific. He was stationed in the Philippines. He was with Headquarters Squadron 24th Pursuit Group at Clark Field. Yeah. And I've seen some of his letters. There's not a lot, but what he sends is actually, it was really enlightening in a way on what was going on in the mindset. I think most of us kind of assume that the war starts at Pearl Harbor Day on December 7th. But in this letter I have from him, October 30th, 1941, so like a month and a half, like hardly a month before Pearl Harbor, he is writing his family and he's talking about an upcoming, something is about to break out. So if you don't mind, I'll read you the letter he wrote.
Oh, we'd love to hear it, yeah.
Kind of give you a picture into Israel and what's going on. So he says, "Dear Gert, Fred, and baby Howard." So Gertrude is his sister. Fred is my great-grandfather. Gertrude and Fred are my great-grandparents. And baby Howie is my grandfather. So he says, "Dear Gert, Fred, and baby Howie, how are you all? I'm feeling fine. Right now, my address is the above one. I don't know how long I'll be here, but write this address anyhow. The situation around here is tense, to put lightly, and we are not expecting the best. However, we feel that there will be a showdown sooner or later, so the sooner the better. Right now, I'm making $46 a month and expect to make more very soon. I'm saving at least $10 a month and save more if I can. If I ever get out of here in one piece, and I expect to, this boy is going to blow himself to a good time when he gets back to the States, as I am putting my money into the U.S. Army finance. Things must be booming right along at home. I hope Fred is getting his share. Baby Howie needs shoes, you know. The baby must be a cute rascal now. How does he get along with Zada, and how is Zada? Give him my regards. I sent him a couple of cards lately. I'm working in the group headquarters personnel section right now, and I'm getting to be quite a clerk. I keep the records of all the officers in the group. They go strong for all the insurance they can get. An insurance man paradise? I'll close this letter now because I haven't much more time to write. I give my regards to Barbara and Sonny, Jenny, Abe, in fact, to all the little and big Goldbergs, Nelsons, Phillipses, and to all my family. Tell Zada and Pa not to worry, as ever, Uncle Sewell. P.S. Don't forget regards to Zada. So there's kind of an inside family joke in this letter, which when I read this, I was just, I don't know, I got this amazing feeling that, okay, I know my uncle. So he talks about an insurance man's paradise. And one of our family things is that my grandfather and my great-grandfather, a bunch of my relatives were all insurance men, but they were terrible businessmen because they gave away as much insurance as they sold. You know, they just wanted to help people.
Right.
So it was kind of a joke. He's like, here, everybody out here, they want insurance. So that's his letter from October 30th, 1941. And there had been one other telegram he'd sent earlier that year where he just says he's doing fine. But that's the last letter we have from him. Then after that, obviously Pearl Harbor was hit. Then the Philippines were hit. And Bataan fell in April of 42. And Gertie, his sister, got a telegram on April 17th. 1942, saying, your brother, Private Israel Goldberg, reported a prisoner of war of the Japanese government in the Philippines, letter following from the adjutant general. And then a month later, in May, so exactly a month later, she gets another telegram saying, report now received from the Japanese government through the International Red Cross that your brother, Private Israel Goldberg, previously reported a prisoner of war, died on May 13 in Southeast Pacific area. The Secretary of War shares your grief and extends his deep sympathy. Letter to follow. So the date obviously isn't accurate because this is May of 1943, but the date's inaccurate because he died August 11, 1942, but it wasn't reported until the following May.
Yeah.
So there's some confusion in her letters about when he died and finding that information out. But after that, she proceeded for like the next several years and on up into the 50s, I think, to write the Department of the Army and everyone she possibly could to try and find out more information about him, but she never did. And she named my aunt after him. Just, it broke her heart, and she honestly, she never got over it because they were very, very close. That bond they had growing up, kind of, you know, them against the world and everything, it was a huge loss for her.
Yeah, it would
when
be.
He died. Yeah. So,
yeah, that letter.
So that is. Go ahead. Sorry.
That's okay. That letter that he wrote home, you know, and you said it was in October of 41.
Yes.
Yeah, that was probably that was right when General MacArthur was making the big build up there in the Philippines because they kind of knew things were getting ready to hit the fan, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So they were building up all the troops that they could build up and all that the president would allow, you know, because at that time they had a Europe first policy. So most of the troops and supplies were going to Europe. But yeah, that's amazing that he got that letter home and was able to communicate with his sister before war broke out. Was there any other letters after the war broke out, or was that just pretty much it?
That's the last one. The letters that my aunt has from Gertrude, there's just a little stack. And so I think, I don't know for positive. I mean, I would hope there's another one, but as far as I understand, the one from October 30th is the last letter he got sent home or survived, I should say, him and Gertrude. So it's a special one because it has so much little history in it, just like everything from the the joke about the insurance to my grandfather, Howard, who was born in 1939. No, he was born in 1941. I'm sorry, the beginning of the year. Because actually, yeah, today's his birthday. Yeah. So it's a real treasured letter, and it patches together parts of the story. I have never seen his military service photo, but a couple of years ago, I'd always wondered what he looked like. I was like, what does Israel look like? I wonder what he looks like. And a couple of years ago, I was with my grandmother, and she pulled out a photo of him. And I knew that he was him and two other men from Gertie's wedding in 1938, I think. And I knew him immediately because it's incredible. Israel's never married, never had any kids. But one of my younger brothers is the spitting image of him, which is remarkable to me that this man who died, 79 years ago, has a great, great nephew who carries his face, his ears, his nose, everything. It's just incredible.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. So he was with the Headquarters Squadron 24th Pursuit Group. Do you know much about after the war broke out, what his duties were? Do you have any inclination into those or into that?
I don't, and I've done research to try and find out, but I've never really come up on anything. The closest I got to it was I used to know a World War II veteran who was, he wasn't in the same squadron. He was in like one of the, like a brother squadron troop right next to it. And my friend told me, he said, oh, I know your uncle's outfit. And this is what was happening the days around Pearl Harbor when it was bombed and when the Philippines were hit. Veteran was able to tell me a couple, but his outfit got pulled out pretty quick.
When Clark Field was bombed, it was bombed about, I think, 6 to 8 hours after Pearl Harbor was. And as soon as Clark Field was bombed, they actually retrained most of the Air Corps as infantry. So members of the 31st Infantry and others, non-commissioned officers, actually trained a lot of these Air Corps guys as infantry, and they were actually put on the front lines in the battle. I don't know if you knew about a lot of that.
Only a little bit. That's really interesting.
They called them the Provisional Air Corps Infantry.
The Provisional? Okay, wow, I didn't know that. All right.
I will send you some stuff on it.
Oh, I'd love to. I've talked to other vets who are regular Army. One of my friends, he was a captain in the Philippine Army, and he's kind of described it a little bit. And honestly, I read about Bataan a lot and read about things that, my uncle would have gone through on Bataan, but I think we kind of all forget the couple of months before Bataan falls, when they're fighting so hard and running short on food and supplies and guns and everything. You don't realize when Bataan fell, everybody was exhausted. They were already exhausted. I mean, that's why we had to surrender. But as a relative, it's kind of hard on my heart to think about my uncle having to go through all of that before the nightmare of Bataan.
Yeah. Yeah. They were on the front lines. They were on the front lines as infantry and actually held the line and counterattacked the Japanese in a few spots. And they fought valiantly. That's for darn sure.
Wow.
So, yeah. So, they go through and, they go through the fighting and stuff. And General King ended up surrendering on 9 April 1941, which kicked off the Bataan Death March. What do you know about Israel and his march north there to Camp O'Donnell?
So, after that, I don't know anything. Actually, growing up, I'd always been told Israel died on the Death March. So, all my life, I thought I had a relative who died on the death march, and it was only when I started doing research and found out it was a lot more complicated that he made it to the camp and then died and everything. So I don't know anything that happened to him after that until the great record of him dying of malaria and anemia. I just know what I've read about what other men went through, and it's a nightmare. It was a real nightmare. Having to survive the long march and then the cattle cars and then the different camps and the disease and the hunger and no water and the Filipinos civilians on the side trying to help the prisoners and then being killed because they're helping the prisoners. So it's really a terrible nightmare. I read a couple years ago, I think the best book I read that helped fill in what happened, because I don't have the ability to know what happened to Israel. Are you familiar with the book Tears in the Darkness?
I am.
Okay, that kind of filled in a whole lot of gaps.
Yeah, and I recommend all the listeners, if they can get that book and read it, read it.
Yes, absolutely. I listened to the audiobook actually when I was driving to the Bataan March, and I had a 17-hour drive, and I think it's a 17-hour audiobook, and I listened to it from start to finish, and it was really gutting because I was listening to the story of my uncle the whole time, you know, of the men who went through this with him. So I highly recommend it. Absolutely.
Yeah. So when did your family find out? You're the one that kind of started this process of trying to get Israel identified. Isn't that correct?
Yes. So his name was one that we just talked about periodically, like, if World War II was brought up or someone asked, I'd been told growing up, oh, you had a great uncle, great, great uncle who died during the war, da, da, da. But I didn't know anything about it. And then in 2014, I was kind of like, okay, I'm ready to stop here, to start looking and finding out about this, not mythical uncle, but you know, he's kind of, all it is family lore.
Right.
So I started looking into it, and that's when I found out, oh, he died in the camp. Well, let me read about this camp. And then there was the possibility of, oh, in fact, he doesn't have a grave. He's buried in an unknown grave. And what does that look like? And that's kind of heartbreaking to me. I've always, my family grew up going to battlefields and cemeteries because we were really big on history. And I always looked at the unknown graves and I would think, who's buried there? You know, whose family doesn't know where he is?
Yeah.
So after I learned that my uncle is buried in one of these unknown graves, my heart even broke more now, because now I know I'm one of those families who there's a nice little plaque somewhere in Manila which says unknown, and my uncle's there, but no one knows it. So that's when I started looking into it and seeing, all right, what can we do? And it's kind of a terrifying process. I just started asking questions and trying to see, I started writing Bataan veterans. I looked up what Bataan survivors were still alive, and I found out there was one in San Antonio. His name was Joseph Alexander, and he was supposed to be the youngest Bataan survivor, and I was so excited. So I wrote him because I thought, I'm going to meet him and talk to him. I was kind of naive, and I thought, maybe he'd know my uncle, you know. And I was like, no. But I wrote him, and unfortunately, he got sick and he passed away. But his wife wrote me a beautiful letter. Aww. She'd read my letter to him, and he died before I could meet him. But that letter affected me so much because it was like I was getting this consent from this Bataan veteran, and it was like, go find your uncle. So ever since then, I just always keyed into. Honestly, I haven't found a lot on him. Bits here and there, people sending me papers and things like the milk. What was it? Not a milk carton you sent. It was the.
It's a death certificate. It reported the death. It was actually filled out in the hospital. It's on the back of back then it was canned milk. So it was on the back of a canned milk label.
Fascinating. That was, you know, so when I first found out he died in a POW camp, then I had hundreds of questions, which is, how did he die? And of course, your thought immediately goes to the worst possible option that you've heard, which is, you know, brutally murdered by a guard, or this, or, you know, so many options. And so I was like, well, how did he die? And finding out that he died of disease, even though it's kind of horrible, it was almost a relief. It was almost like, okay, he was sick. He wasn't murdered. He wasn't killed. He didn't starved. I mean, he probably starved to death too, but it wasn't something horribly violent. It was just kind of a relief. So the little bits here and there have really made him come alive in so many ways. You know, his photo and the letters and learning about how he died and the people who were around him at the time.
Yeah. But in a sense, it was kind of a horrible death because it could have been cured pretty quick with just a little bit of medicine that the Japanese were withholding.
And, you know, you're right. And I know that because this other Bataan vet I met and became friends with, he had two friends who sacrificed their life for him. The vet had the same thing. He had malaria and anemia, and they found ways to find those little foods to smuggle them in and keep the vet alive. And so sometimes you have to pause and think, it's incredible that, you know, you got a couple men lying in the beds next to each other, sick and dying, and, you know, one person gets what they need and can survive and the others can't. So it's, yeah, there's a lot to take in and think about. But it's still kind of early. He didn't, right. It wasn't horribly brutal because because that's what you think of. When you think about a Japanese POW camp, is you think about the most brutal thing out there. You think about Louis Zamperini, you know.
Exactly.
So I've just been kind of following Hansel and Gretel trail, little what's it called, breadcrumbs here and there. Right. And last year I finally wrote the Army Casualty Office and said, can I get his IDPF, and which is the individual personal death file. So
individual deceased personnel file.
Right. And I got to read through that. It's tons of pages. I think I want to say 70 pages, but there's just all sorts of information from the burial recovery. He was buried with 10 or 12 other men, and their names are listed in different files. And in 1947, I believe, and you know better than I do probably, a lot of the bodies were taken out and reburied in Manila.
They were transferred to the Manila Mausoleum. It was above ground storage, and then they were reburied after they couldn't make any identifications.
Wow. Yes, that's right. So, after I got the Army Casualty Office sent me that, they were able to assign a genealogist to do research on his case, who then in her turn, she's a wonderful woman, she got my aunt.
Most pancake syrups contain artificial flavors, artificial colors, and high fructose corn syrup. But there's an all-natural option free of additives in the same aisle. Real maple syrup from Canada is made from one ingredient. So turn the bottle and check the label. Is your syrup real maple? 100% pure maple, straight from Mother Nature herself. One ingredient, one source, one flavor. Pure maple from Canada.com.
Captain, we've got a new bearing.
Periscope. Vacationers earning 3 times the points on a tour package with the PenFed Pathfinder Rewards credit card.
Impossible, sir. They're civilians.
Whether you're in uniform or not, PenFed's Pathfinder Rewards card gives you 3 times the points for all travel, not just flights. 1.5 points for everything else.
That'll be great for my next vacation.
As soon as we're back from deployment.
PenFed Credit Union. Visit PenFed.org/Pathfinder. Cash advances, credit card checks, and balance transfers are excluded from earning rewards. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA.
To submit a DNA sample, and that's kind of where it is now in 2020. We have the DNA sample submitted, which is good because there's not really a lot of other options besides her, and just moving forward from there to see if it's possible to get in contact with some of the other men's relatives who were buried with Israel. It's very daunting, but it's possible. Because it's happened before, and obviously you've been working on things like this. So,
yeah, we just had another case similar to yours. The remains were just actually disinterred here about a week ago and arrived in Hawaii. So,
wow.
Yeah, so it's definitely possible, and it's likely. It's just the DPAA and they're just so backlogged in their lab that they're not getting these done in a timely manner. And what I mean by a timely manner is in a lot of these men still have sisters and, you know, sisters and brothers that are still alive, and they don't have too many more years left to see their brothers, you know, their brother come home and be identified. So, yeah, I wish they could remove that backlog in the lab.
Right.
So. So what's that was the last word then you had from, the government side of it, was the government genealogist was able to get a relative of yours closer to Israel to get the DNA sample.
Yes, that's the last. I think because I'm so distant from him technically, because I'm a great great niece, they were going doing more contact through my great aunt, his niece. So I haven't heard from them since about it, and it's just, I think it's just been slow,
slow. How long ago was that?
I have to check the date, but I think I got in touch with the Army office probably last spring.
Okay.
And they assigned the genealogist several months later. Like I think 3 months later, 3 or 4 months later.
Okay, so this is all real fresh then.
Yes.
So what's your family's hopes here? Have they decided on where they're gonna, if when he's identified, have you guys decided on where he's gonna be buried at?
This is an interesting question because there hasn't really been a lot of discussion. I've been, as the main one kind of heading it up, thought about this a bit. He has a headstone. So Israel has a headstone in Beverly, Massachusetts, where he was where he was born. I've got the documentation where they requested a military headstone for him back after the war. And for me personally, at the end of the day, what I would love more than anything else in the world is to be able to identify what remains possible and have him reburied, in Manila in a proper grave with a name and a headstone. I don't think he needs to come back to Massachusetts. And honestly, I think, it's a big thing to talk for the dead, to say, oh, this is what they'd like, because you don't know. But knowing, having grown up around lots of military and other servicemen, I think he would love nothing more than to be buried at Manila with the rest of his buddies who he fought with for so long. So if we could just get him a proper burial and headstone with a name, so that when people, when little children, when other people walk through that cemetery, they can go, oh, Israel Goldberg died 1942. Here's a human. There is someone, some mother's son, some sister's brother buried in this grave, as opposed to just being a name on a wall or an unknown grave, So that's what I would like. I think that's what the rest of the family would probably like as well.
Yeah, and hopefully we can get this done in our lifetime here.
I would love that. And you know what? If nothing else, knowing that this opportunity and possibility is out there is very, it's helpful for other people, because I have other friends who have relatives who are MIAs and POWs, and to start on the process of my own uncle, it kind of gives hope for the other people. And if anything, at the end of the day, even if we never figure out, if we can't ever get the proper identification for him, I do know that in the last 6 years that I've been, taking the baby steps, trying to find him, Israel has gone in my family from being, family lore, family myth, to being a real living, breathing relative who had personality and humor and worked hard and sacrificed. I mean, he's become so real to me now, and the rest of my family, it's not just one of those distant relatives you hear about, but I have no connection to. So I think I'll be great if nothing else happens. And I know at least he's not going to be forgotten, and we've given him a little bit more life than he's had the last, 79 years.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll see.
Yeah. It's the same thing I hear from a lot of these families, that sometimes they spoke about him, sometimes they didn't, after 79 years, these men are getting so distant from living relatives now that the memories are fading, for lack of a better term.
And, right.
And that's just it. It's just, what would be your recommendation if there's another family that might be listening to this podcast? What is your recommendation to them if they might have a missing in action relative and haven't really taken the steps yet? What do you recommend to them?
I'd say first, ask what family members they know. Ask all your family members for what information, because you never know what nugget you're going to find. I've that's the first step. And then honestly, just start Googling, researching, and then very easy is submitting a request for their either military personnel file. You can do that through St. Louis. There's a fee. I think there's a fee attached, or you can go there in person. Or if they're an MIA or POW, writing to the Army Casualty Office, requesting it. I mean, that's the first step to finding out more about the relative. I think a lot of people, I think the idea of writing the military is a very intimidating process, but it's easy. You just follow the guidelines, the steps. The information is out there. You just have to read it and email right away. So
exactly. Yeah, it's a pretty simple process that, you know, and don't be afraid to give a DNA sample either, you know.
Absolutely. There's nothing terrifying. I mean, if I could give a DNA sample, I would have done it 6 years ago. Unfortunately, I can't.
Just a simple cheek swab.
Right. Well, and today, I think there's so many DNA groups out there, you know, to help you learn about your ancestors, you know, 23andMe. So if you've even considered doing that, you should definitely consider doing it with the military. They just send you the kit and it's taken care of. No problem. It's not like they're going to use it for anything else.
No, and they can't. And that's the whole thing is they can't use it for anything else. It's actually protected. It's under the HIPAA laws and everything else. So all that information is private. They don't give it out. It's very well protected. It's actually managed by the Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory in Dover. And it's a pretty well protected system. So, and it's not online to where anybody can look at it or anything else. So it's a very well protected system.
So basically there isn't any reason to almost use a double negative. There's no reason to not send in a DNA sample.
Exactly.
You must. Yeah,
exactly. Well, I appreciate you telling us about Israel and the steps that you're taking to try to get them identified. Now, I know you are a founder of a nonprofit group, Operation Meatball. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about what you do there?
Yes. I'll cut it down short because the Operation Meatball story can kind of run long. But Operation Meatball is a nonprofit I started with my two sisters about 6 years ago, which it's dedicated to honoring the last veterans of World War II and recording their stories for future generations and honestly providing practical encouragement and life enrichment programs for the guys who are now in their 90s. I mean, I have breakfast with them once a week and they're all like 95, 96, 97. So we started it, and it is kind of linked hand in hand with Israel's story because in a way, I want to give the living World War II veterans the honor and the love and appreciation, which I can't give my uncle because he died. We started it back in 2014. My sisters and I and our family went to Normandy for the anniversary of D-Day. I knew some D-Day veterans, and we talked with veterans, and we'd always been interested in history. And after getting back from that trip, we realized this was a mission that we had to follow because there are so few veterans left. And, you know, I've never had the ability to talk to a World War I veteran. I wanted to, but they died before I could. And Civil War veterans, you know, it happened over 150 years ago, but we don't have any stories of what it was like to know them. We have stories from the war, but not from who they were as the individuals. So my two sisters, Faith and Jubilee, we were like, we have to do this. We have been given a time where I was 17, my sister Jubilee was 16, and then Faith was 14. We're like, look, we've got this time. We're finishing school. We need to devote this. So the last 6 years, we've done everything from put on USO-style programs at car museums. My sister Faith, she sings magnificently, from music from the 1920s to the 50s. We've collaborated with programs like Honor Flight, and in everything from the shows to home visits and personal one-on-one time with the vet where we just talk to them. And it's more than just their military service. It's what was it like growing up? Tell me about your family. What motivated you to become the type of person you are? Because the veterans who served in World War II, they were very unique and very special. Everything they went through is almost like they'd been prepared and trained for it by having to go through the Great Depression and learning how to just fight hard through everything. And so that's what we do. I don't, you know, the veterans, there's less of them now than when I started. There's only a handful of World War II vets left, but they're still out there. So part of what OM does is encourage other people and just give them ways to find World War II veterans and meet them and talk to them and ask them about their stories so that, like the ones who didn't make it back, we can show honor to the ones who are still living as well.
Oh, that's a cool mission there. And I'm jealous because you get to go to all these old battlefields and stuff too.
That's, you know, there's nothing like going to a battlefield. And we've been really blessed to be able to help take veterans back at different times. And I'm not in the military. I've never been in the military and I've never been in combat. But standing with an Army paratrooper, it's a place where he was wounded, you know, there's nothing like it. And having him point to you exactly where the sniper was that shot him, what he was doing in his front. It's incredible. I'm getting chills thinking about it. And my children are probably never going to get to meet a World War II veteran, honestly. So I want to just take every moment I can and record their stories and capture it so that my kids and my grandkids can learn about it, you know, secondhand, vicariously. Yeah.
Exactly. And it sounds like you're going to be taking a little trip here in the next, I guess it's here in a couple weeks. Tell us a little bit about the Bataan Memorial Death March and you've been doing it for quite a while. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about it.
Yes. So the Bataan Memorial Death March happens in March every year. And they've had, I don't remember how many, they've had 30 years almost they've been doing this. And a couple of years ago, I heard about it. It's a marathon. It's 26.2 miles in the middle of the New Mexico desert at White Sands Missile Range. They get about 7,000 to 8,000 marchers and runners out there every year. I will tell you, I did the whole marathon once, and then I've done the half and a couple of times. I've never experienced so much physical exhaustion and pain and suffering. I love marathons, but this was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. You're literally walking through the desert, running through it, 95 degree temperatures. It's almost perfectly simulated. But they do it every year to honor the Bataan marchers, the Bataan veterans and the Bataan survivors and everyone who died. And it's incredibly moving because you're surrounded by thousands of American men and women and military, and everyone, almost everyone has, you know, I'm marching for this Bataan person. I'm marching for this. Everyone is marching for someone who is in Bataan. They're being remembered, and it's a miserable experience, but one I'm so happy to endure because it makes you appreciate in a very small way what our soldiers experienced at Bataan. Like, we don't know. We don't have, there aren't Japanese guards prodding us along and taking our water away from us when we march, but in a small way, it's like, wow.
Yeah, or bayoneting and killing you if you fall behind.
Right. It's the Bataan Death March, what was excruciating in every way. And so to be able to simulate in a very small way that, it's an honor, and it's something I'm so proud to do for my uncle. It's another bridging of the gap and trying to connect a little bit what he and the other guys went through. And my sister Faith is doing it with me this year. And I told her when I asked her if she wanted to do it, I said, do you want to do this? It's the most miserable, horrible, painful experience you'll ever have in your life. Probably worse than childbirth. I'm sure of it. But you want to do this? And she's like, absolutely, definitely. For my uncle, of course. So, and you know what? I'm getting excited thinking about this. One of the most moving, incredible parts of it is when you leave on that march and you know, I've got 26 miles of desert. There are Bataan survivors sitting in chairs, shaking hands and sending you off with good luck. You know, you're going to do great. And when you get back, you've marched 26 miles and you're exhausted and you want to die. There, the Bataan veterans are there again, welcoming you back.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't help but cry because they know what you're doing and you know what they've been through. And so there's kind of this silent understanding of what's about to happen. And it's magnificent. It's so magnificent.
Tell us a little bit about the Colonel.
Colonel, yes. Colonel Ben, Colonel Skardon. I met Colonel Skardon the first time I went to Bataan. He was only 100 then. He's going to be 103 this summer. His name is Ben Skardon. And during the Battle of Bataan, before it fell, he was a captain in the Philippine Army. And he received 2 silver stars in that 4 months and 4 bronze stars. And,
wow.
And he survived the march and was in a POW camp. He survived 3 hell ships, 2 of which were sunk under him. Basically, anything that could be thrown at him, he got. Then he went and worked in a Japanese POW camp in Japan. What he went through was so unbelievable that even today, he's 103, his family and his relatives are still hearing things for the first time. I think it was just a couple of years ago, he pulled out a set of spoons that he had brought with him from the camp. And no one had ever seen these before, but he pulled them out and he was like, yeah, these are what I had in the camp. He almost died. He had 2 friends from his Clemson days who gave their lives for him. They nursed him when he was sick. They rubbed his feet to help him with the pain. And they smuggled in food at the cost of their own life. So he the last 11 or 12 years, he has marched multiple miles of the Bataan Memorial Death March in their honor. I think he goes 8 miles most years. The last year he just did 3, which when you're 102 years old, 3 miles in the desert is unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And I went with him one of the years I marched the whole 8 miles with him. And I've never seen anything like it. He didn't complain. He didn't talk about being tired. When we hit the sand, he got really serious and he was just quiet. But every mile he paused. He goes with what's called Ben's Brigade. It's all these Clemson friends who just march with him. And every mile marker, he'll have a witty comment or something to encourage us and keep us going. And I've never seen anything like it. I've never met a 103-year-old who does anything like that. So yeah. He's spectacular. Ben Skardon. If you just Google his name, you'll come up with – he did a documentary, 60 Minutes. There's tons of articles on him. His last name is spelled – Skardon. Magnificent man. And when I asked him, so I met him the first time I met him and was talking to him, I asked him about my uncle, because you never know, you know, there's only 75,000, 80,000 POW, so who knows? But I asked him, I said, Colonel Skardon, my uncle was at the same camp as you and he was sick and he died this year, etc. And he said, when did your uncle die? And I said, he died August of 1942. And he told, and Colonel Skard looked at him in August. He said, July and August had the highest death rates at Cabanatuan. And he said, we lost 100 men a day. And his eyes just got moist as he's telling me this. Yeah. And my eyes started to water, because here's a man who 75, 79 years after the fact, he still gets emotional knowing all the men that died around him, and yet he survived. So he's special. He's very special.
Yeah, it was a living hell is what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's going to be there this year?
I have to find out. I need to call him and ask. I hope so. He's been there every year since, well, for I think 11 or 12 years. So I hope he can make it again this year.
Yeah, so do I.
He'll be out there with Ben's Brigade all in orange. You can't miss him. I mean, it's the best advertising for Clemson you'll ever see.
That's pretty cool. Well, yeah. we wish you very good luck on the march.
I know
I probably wouldn't make it the first 2 miles, so.
I'm going to make it as far as I can. But you know what? Knowing that people have done it before, we can do it.
Exactly. So you signed up for the full march, or are you doing the half?
Or what? I'm doing the full.
You're doing the full this year.
I'm doing the full. There was half a moment where I asked my sister, I said, do you want to do the half? And she said, are you kidding? If I'm going to suffer, I'm going to do it the whole way.
Oh, man.
So all or nothing.
All or nothing. Well, is there anything that I might have missed or anything that you want to bring up that we might have forgot to talk about?
I don't think so. I would just encourage anyone listening, look into your family's history. It's wonderful that there's so many things promoting it now, you know, promoting ancestry and looking into it because it's so important. There's a quote from a long time ago. I think it was General Robert E. Lee says, "History teaches us to hope." And I grew up with the understanding that you have to look at the past. You look at history to know what's going to happen and how to interpret what to do in the future. You have to, because otherwise you move forward in huge ignorance and you want to know where you came from. So learning about Israel and my family and everything, it went through all the hardships, the penny whistles, the burning it up, working hard and Israel dying. And, you know, for me, he gave up his life for tons of great grand nieces and nephews you would never meet. And he didn't know they would exist, but he knew he was doing the right thing. And it's really moving and emotional. And I encourage everyone, please look up your family, talk to your family. If you have grandparents or great grandparents or uncles, just ask them questions. It doesn't need to be intimidating. And you'll be really grateful someday. If you aren't now, you'll be really grateful someday.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Every one of those men died for the freedoms that we now enjoy.
Yes.
All of us.
Yes. The quote you have, I think it's on your website, about they gave their, I'm going to mess up the quote now. I know it so well, but it just ran out of my head, but they gave up their future. Some of these guys, Israel is forever 29 years old. He gave up the rest of his life, the possibility to have children, to have a future so that other people could. So people like Ben Skarden could. So it's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. That quote
grateful.
When you go home, tell them of us and say for your tomorrow, we gave our today.
Thank you. Yes. Yep. That's one of my favorite quotes of all time.
It's exactly what they did too. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast, Liberty, and telling us about your Uncle Israel and telling us about Operation Meatball and your suffering and sacrifice at the Bataan Memorial Death March coming up. And I was just on their website the other day looking into it a little bit more. For our listeners, for Operation Meatball, how can people look you up, find you, and know what you do?
Yes. So you can just look up OperationMeatball.com, and we've got a Facebook page, and then on Instagram, it's just Operation Meatball. Literally like Operation and then Meatball like meatballs and spaghetti sauce. So.
Okay. And you're on Facebook, Instagram, and all those too?
Yes. Not Twitter, because I may be a millennial, but that's just way above my pay grade. I can't figure it out. But Instagram, Facebook, and then OperationMeatball.com.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out the Twitter thing, too. I'll tweet every once in a while.
Yep.
All righty. Well, thank you for coming on the podcast. Thank you for listening to Stories of Sacrifice, World War II, American POW MIAs in the Philippines. This has been a production of the U.S. POW MIA Family Locating. You can find us on the web at uspowmiafamilylocating.com. Opinions expressed in this podcast are our own and given in the best intention. Overall, the POW MIA accounting community is doing what it can with limited resources. It is our hope additional federal funding will be provided, along with additional partnerships established to disinter and process the remains of our unknowns located in the national cemeteries. You can help by contacting your congressional representatives and asking that they implement a DNA lead policy for those unknown POW MIAs. Thank you for listening.
So then I dropped some garlic and croutons on there, and the rest is salad history. I made the best salad ever, people, and now I'm making the best app. The Caesar Sportsbook app got live in-game betting, parlays, and Caesar rewards. Caesar salad ain't got nothing on my app. Nothing!
Must be 21. Gambling problem? Call, text, or chat 1-888-532-3500. Download the Caesar Sportsbook app. Your app is ready, Emperor.
Welcome to Parent-Teacher Night. Oh, yes, Miss Garner.
If you have one of those airline credit cards, you're probably not earning double miles on every purchase.
You're right. My card only gets extra miles on some types of purchases.
With the Capital One Venture card, you earn unlimited double miles everywhere.
Wait, but where can we use them?
You can use Capital One Venture miles on any travel purchase.
Venture gets an A+.
Capital One, what's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.